I guess, for this entire hour, because he has written one of the most remarkable collections of short stories I have ever read, and I am a huge fan of the short story. I am maybe in part of a diminished crowd, but I can't tell you how much I love Irwin Shaw and John O'Hara and John Cheever and George Saunders and all short story writers. You, my favorite nonfiction writer in Chicago, what are you doing writing a book of short stories?
Well, I've always sort of wanted to write short stories. Years ago, 35 years ago, I studied short story writing at the University of Michigan with a couple of great professors, Rick. A guy named Charles Baxter, who's really one of the absolute masters of the short story form, and a guy named Nicholas Del Banco. And I
know him, too.
And I just had a great experience there. And even in my many years of being a journalist and an author and an academic, I've always written stories on the side. It's always been this, like, incredible avocation, you know, just something that I loved doing, and there's not much of a market for it, but I'd get them published in good places. I knew I was okay at it, and you know, I just, when I got done with my last book, The King of Confidence, a nonfiction book, I said, you know, I'm just going to try to pull a collection together and see how it goes.
Is this collection, and the collection is titled The Registry of Forgotten Objects, which is the concluding story in this thing, and it's it's pretty amazing. It's like something out of a futuristic dystopian. The book goes all over the place. Before we get into this book, and I want to read some things from it and talk more about it, where are you from?
So I grew up in Downers Grove, and, you know, was a really wonderful childhood out there. My parents were not like the rest of the people out there. They were not only liberal lefty types, but longtime political activists.
Wasn't burned down.
We came close a couple of times. And my mom was a longtime chair of the Democratic Party out there. There's actually an award named after her, which I love, and she would have absolutely
loved.
What's
the award for? What's it presented
it's for? You know, they give it to a pal out
You're
there.
You're the next only Democrat in DuPage County.
You know, it's just honoring the work she and other groundbreaking women did out there. Now the Democrats are very strong in DuPage County, but when I lived there, they you know, my parents were lucky if they got 30-35% of the vote.
Wow.
They considered that, like, break out the champagne.
Sure.
And so, and then I went to the University of Illinois, and then later on went to the University of, and I studied journalism there. I was a longtime journalist.
Why did you study journalism?
Oh, I just probably, you know, I just loved it. I mean, I guess I was part of, you know, if I look at it in terms of demographics, I was part of the post-Watergate boom, all the President's Men boom. I've never read the book and didn't love the movie, but I did grow up in a generation where people accurately thought journalism could change the world. I still believe journalism can change the world. And I was, I know your story enough, Rick, to know that you started out as a teenager and have the old school working your way up through the paper. And I was lucky enough at United Press International, around the corner here from where we're talking, to work with some guys like that, guys who'd started as copy boys. And so I was the beginning of a new generation of sort of professionalized journalists with college degrees, but we were lucky to be in this transition period. And it was just such a
and you were lucky to be in the business in this town, I think. I mean, this was a great journalism town.
Yeah, I learned so much from so many people here, and it just was a lot of fun to be a young journalist here, I gotta say. You know, I worked the overnight shift for a long time at UPI, and, you know, we'd get up and have breakfast at the Billy Goat, and, you know, it was a lot of fun. And so that's sort of, I still really have such admiration for and love of journalists. They're still like, I'd rather talk to journalists than just about anyone else in the world. And
wow.
I just think they're so engaged and curious and interested in the planet.
Well, the best of them are drawn to the business out of an insatiable curiosity, I've always felt.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. And
did you aspire? And it could be a heady. I mean, at the time, certainly it could be like a narcotic, and you must have wanted at some point. UPI is one thing, but a daily paper is a complete other thing. Did you aspire to a job on one of the papers here?
You know, I think I realized fairly early on that I was a slow writer.
Really?
Yeah. I can hit deadlines, and at United Press International, I was doing
that's a lot of deadlines.
Radio and TV copy, so there were hourly deadlines. I did it. I'm okay at it. But I liked magazine work a lot better. I like to be able to sit and reread and reread and reread something.
Mm-hmm.
I always say, you know, I'm just kind of slow at everything, and I'm only smart in slow motion, you know? So with the stories in this book, you know, the first drafts would have been a far cry in a lot of cases from where I got with them. And I sort of definitely I'm a person, you know, it's a cliche, but I learn to think through writing, and I learn what I think about the world through writing.
I know none of the stories, I don't think any of the stories in the Register of Forgotten Objects were written at that time when you got home from the Billy Goat. But did short story writing and creative writing, I hate that phrase too, I really don't like it, I know you've taught it and stuff, but I creative writing bothers me a bit. But were you writing on the side, slow as you might have been on daily deadlines?
A little bit. I mean, we had a small writers group, an incredibly talented group of people in that writers group of young journalists. Larry Doyle, who later wrote for The Simpsons and
The New Yorker.
He wrote for The New Yorker all the time. Ted Cox, the wonderful sports columnist for The Reader for years, who had a great collection out. Just a bunch of talented people. And I did get some work done. It was just, you know, a fun avocation. And I think at that time, Rick, you know, a lot of creative young people, I'm sure yourself included, journalism was sort of a great place where we could go and think about the world and get paid for it. And so
And also write about it. I mean, you had to marshal. You go out to cover something, even if it's a, you know, an entertainment story, you have to marshal your facts and you have to express yourself. And then there's something very heady about seeing that byline. I mean, I'm not still thrilled by it, but there's a kick to it even now.
Oh, I totally agree. You know, when I saw the mock-up of the cover of this
book.
Oh,
I'll bet.
And it wasn't like I've made it now because no one cares about short stories. But it was like, dang, there it is. There's my name on a book of short stories.
You have written three nonfiction books, each one of which I have raved about, justifiably raved about. It was nevertheless hard to get a collection of short stories published, yes?
Yeah, it was pretty hard. And there's not a huge demand, I think, when the internet came in, everyone said, oh, this is going to be the short story form, and also the long-form nonfiction form, and it just didn't pan out. I just think, you know, I gave a speech at the public library, I don't know, a decade ago, and the theme of my speech was, we're all poets now, you know? And that wasn't an insult. I just think whether it's journalism, fiction, except for certain kinds of fiction, or whatever, we increasingly, the capitalism doesn't support what we do.
And just sat on in the 5 o'clock hour, I don't know if you heard on that thing, a wonderful, nice woman named Jenny Beineman, who is devoting herself now to haiku. Talk about, you know, five syllables, seven syllables, five syllables. I get it. When you stayed in journalism, you went to UPI, then you went to In These Times?
Yes.
That was an interesting. Tell people what that was.
So In These Times was and is a prominent magazine, political magazine on the left. By prominent, I do not mean big circulation.
Yes, that's for sure.
But it's comparable to The Nation or Mother Jones. And that was an amazing experience for me, an amazing creative experience for me. I was lucky to work for a guy named Jim Weinstein.
One amazing human being.
Yeah, he was a great, a historian of the left, but also, as he called himself, a Groucho Marxist. So he had been a former communist and testified in front of Joseph McCarthy and all that, but he was one of the funniest guys and just made the newspaper or the magazine work a blast, and I just learned so much from him.
He and my old photographer partner, Chuck Osgood, owned a house together.
Oh, yeah.
That tells you all you need to know. We'll be back in a couple minutes with Miles Harvey to talk more about his career, and then the half hour we will talk about this really remarkable book. He says the short story is dead. Well, maybe he's bringing it back to life with this amazing book. Welcome back. I'm talking with Miles Harvey. We've got him almost finished with his journalism career. He worked for In These Times. You wrote for Outside, or did you work for Outside magazine?
I was a book columnist.
Wow.
For Outside, and I had the
John Ramis editing it then, or
I'm trying to remember.
Don't worry.
Yeah. The person I worked kind of closely with, well, a couple of people. One was Michael Paterniti, who was a roommate of mine in graduate school and an amazing nonfiction writer and now author of a couple of amazing books. And Andrea Barrett is the person I shared the column with, who's now, you know, just an amazing fiction writer. And I didn't have that much contact, but a lot of email contact with her, and she was kind enough to blurb this book, which meant a lot to me, because I really admire her.
Where were you living, Miles, during your journalistic heyday in Chicago?
Oh, it's funny. We were just talking about that last night. I lived in what's now called the East Village, Rick, but it was just a bunch of workers' houses east of Ukrainian Village when we lived there.
We used to ironically
call it the East Village in our incredibly cheap apartments there. And then one day we were outside and the real estate agents were hanging "Welcome to the East Village" banners from the light poles, and
we're out of here.
And but it was a great place. I sometimes with my students, and now I have two kids in their 20s. I just think Chicago is always and always will be a great place to live, but I think we just could live really, really cheaply there. And it gave us the freedom, I think, in certain ways to create and to sort of find ourselves that I hope kids have now. I don't know. But I certainly think for us, I mean, I shared an apartment with a guy who's still one of my closest friends, who we paid $250 a month for a two-bedroom. And I think there was one heater in the two-bedroom, like one gas heater.
You're lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're lucky.
But it was just fine, and we had a lot of chances just to sort of hang out and think and do some creative work.
And then you started a sort of freelance career, almost exclusively freelance, yes?
Yeah, I worked as a freelancer for over a decade.
So did I. That's a tough life.
It's a tough life.
And as you're moving into your 30s, as I suppose you were at the time, it becomes a scary life.
It's funny you mentioned that, because my academic career began when one day my wife and I realized we had, definitely two children, a mortgage, and $35 in the bank, and no paychecks coming for quite a while.
Your wife's an actress.
Yeah. And so we lived for years on two freelancers, and we lived a good life, and we don't have really...
regrets or...
Oh, no. And we don't have big fancy schmancy tastes. And we're lucky that we have friends who've always been willing to either, when we were broke, either take us out to dinner or come over to our place for spaghetti kind of thing.
And
but it did get to the point where it got, as you say, scary.
Yeah.
And so I had been starting to teach again at Northwestern, thanks to the wonderful poet and fiction writer Reg Gibbons.
What a nice guy.
Yeah. And I really liked it. They liked me.
What were you teaching?
I was teaching creative nonfiction, they call it. Okay. That's the word the catchphrase I don't love either. Yeah. But it's an invention of academia and the silos in academia.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
We might call it narrative journalism in some, but it's more than narrative journalism. And then I did a journalism fellowship at University of Michigan, which was a great thing. And then after that, I realized, I need to get a full-time job in academia, and lucked into a job first at University of New Orleans. And while there, saw that there was an opening at DePaul, and really lucked into it. I'm not embarrassed to say that I wasn't their first choice. I think they're very glad they hired me, but that has been just a huge blessing. DePaul values. I'm sort of a jack of all trades, master of.
Well, you've also, I do want to devote a half hour to the short of the book, but you also started Big Shoulders Books there, which is an independent publishing arm, and has done some remarkable. Talk about Big Shoulders Books.
Yeah, thank you.
Because I've covered that too.
Been so kind to that.
It's
endeavor.
Not kind.
Yeah, so we started, Michelle Morano, Chris Green, and I, Chris Solis Green, two of my colleagues at DePaul, I think 11 or 12, maybe 13 years ago now, we started this publishing adventure, Big Shoulders Books. It's a crazy idea. We give all our books away for free. The idea is we amplify Chicago voices that might not otherwise be heard or heard as much. And it's kind of a social justice nonprofit publishing venture, but we make, as you know, Rick, these beautiful books and powerful books. And we're really proud of what we've done there, and we do them with our students, so it's sort of a laboratory experience for us. And there's
I just think it's going to be, first of all, it's enlightening for the general public, the people who might pick up your books, such as How Long Will I Cry, Voices of Youth Violence. Was that the first one?
That was the first one, and there are 50,000 plus copies of that out in the world.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah, and they still use that in schools, and I don't know, they used to use it in the Cook County Jail as an empathy creator.
And it's got to be so empowering for the kids.
Yeah, I think so. I think, it's oral history, and I know I know you were close friends with Studs. I knew him a little and was a big fan of his, of Studs Terkel, of course. I think the thing about oral history that's amazing is people hear their own voices in these stories, and I'm working on another Big Shoulders book project now, where we're talking about, it's based on the Southeast Side and the old steel mill area, and sort of talking about environmental justice, environmental racism, but through human individual stories. So, my students and I have been going out for a couple of years and interviewing all sorts of interesting people.
Sue Garza?
I haven't talked to her yet, but probably should.
Interesting. She's the daughter of the head of the steelworkers union out there.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Now, right. And we've talked to so many interesting people. The guy I took for myself is one of the guys who runs the drawbridges down there.
Oh, fantastic.
It was so much fun. I can't even tell you. And so cool to be inside this old drawbridge with these gigantozoid gears.
That is
grinding.
The funny thing is that Southeast Side is a part of Chicago that virtually no one sees except the people who live there.
I'm embarrassed to say how little I for
don't be embarrassed. There's no, why would, unless yeah. Sue Sadlowski Garza, Ed Sadlowski was the head of the union, one of the great characters in the history of this town. We're done talking about his journalism career. We're done talking about his teaching career, unless it comes up somehow. One of the stories in the Registry of Forgotten Objects is based a little bit on his time teaching in New Orleans. I'll tell you that much. four faces.
Yeah.
Or going to school in New Orleans. You didn't teach it. You went
no,
to
I know. I taught there. Oh, yeah, okay. No, I mean, New Orleans had a real impact on me. And so it's sort of...
Yeah, this is I've been to New Orleans a few times, and I felt like I was back in New Orleans with four faces. We got to take a news break, and then Miles Harvey and Rick Kogan will talk for another half hour. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm just talking off air with Miles Harvey. Not that I don't listen to the commercials on this fine station. You've heard about his background. We're not going to talk much about his wife. You can maybe see her on a stage somewhere. She's an actress or a film somewhere. We're going to talk about his collection of short stories. He has written, and when you go, and he does have a website like every good author should, it's milesharvey.com. I'm not going to spell it for you because you're smart people and you know how to read. You'll also get a look at his the three nonfiction books that I just adore, Island of Lost Maps, The King of Confidence, and Painter in a Strange Land, three of the best nonfiction books ever written by a Chicago author. All right, Miles Harvey, The Registry of Forgotten Objects. Are some of these stories, you said, you know, you found time, you wanted to go back to short story writing. Are some of these stories older? Are some of these stories you started 10 years ago?
Yeah,
give me the chronology.
At least
this.
One of them is actually about 20 years old.
Wow.
So I had six older stories when I sort of started doing this. And I just had this great writing jag in which I wrote a bunch of short stories in quick succession, which, as I said to you earlier, I'm a slow writer, so that's over the course of a couple of years. And, you know, when I started, I first sort of wanted to try to, I mean, I think one of the things that's nice about being, I'm in my 60s now, an older writer, is that you have kind of this intimate relationship with your work and this empathy for your work, and you're just really good at listening to it and kind of listening to what it wants to say to you, and that's a really sweet thing. And I was kind of listening to the older stories, and as I wrote the newer stories, and I started to feel these stories wanted to be connected, and I didn't want to have these a really tight tie, which we call story cycle.
Yeah, sure,
where,
sure,
you know,
sure.
Classic example would be Winesburg, Ohio, where it's just different characters in this little town. But I did want kind of these quiet linkages, and I started thinking about the way objects work in the stories, and I started thinking maybe the objects wanted to be those linkages. And so objects are just really interesting things. They outlive us. They're just resonant with stories, Rick. And
well, not me. I mean, I love all the stories in here, frankly. I really do on one level or something. The Registry of Forgotten Objects is... I think I saw something once, Miles, like some, I don't know if it was some, you know, Antiques Roadshow or something, or maybe it was a documentary or something where people were talking about a certain object that obviously looked like some kind of old tool, and nobody knew what it was for. And I found that fascinating. And this seems to be, I don't know if it's the seed of this story, but I felt in this story, I felt like, oh my God.
Hey, no, absolutely. I mean, I think there's this guy, you may have interviewed him, Rick, named Donovan Hone, who's just a wonderful nonfiction writer. And many years ago in Harper's, he wrote this book called, long piece called Romance of Rust, where he followed around, I think it's his uncle, who just goes around to farm sales and buys stuff up. And I just remember in this story that Donovan wrote, there was this line about, or a couple of lines about his uncle buying these objects that no one knew what they were, like tools that no one knew what they were.
Yeah.
That we'd just forgotten their use. And, you know, that just really, it was a great piece, and it really captured my imagination. And I think that partially informed this story set in undefined but distant future where a lot of the objects of our everyday life have lost all meaning.
Meaning,
yeah.
I just want to read it, and I'm flying to another story. Here's an example of Miles Harvey's reading. This is from a chapter that is really a good chapter, too, called Balm of Life. strange to think that they had lives of their own, all these objects, lives that would outlast her and even the house by decades, maybe centuries, lives as mysterious as those of the strangers across the room, their skin incandescent in the half-light, their sport coats making her think of ushers at a ballpark from when she was a girl, pretzel salt on her tongue and cigar smoke in the air. No thought of it in years, those Sunday doubleheaders with her father, long dead, and her big brother, also dead. The past suddenly so luminous she didn't even need to close her eyes to see it. You can't possibly write those sentences sitting in a like this. And that seems to me, Miles Harvey, just too beautiful to pop into the page from your lazy writing techniques.
Yeah, I just, you know, and that passage is a passage about just how I think we get transported by objects. And you know, I think a lot of this book is how the past impinges the present in different ways. And that story, actually, Rick, is one of the only stories in the book. I'm not much of an autobiographical fiction writer, but that was based very loosely on before my mother died. There was a block party at our house in Downers Grove, and these two incredibly elderly men, I can't remember if they were actually twins, but I think they did have the same jackets, color jacket on, came and basically said, "Can we look at your house?" They had grown up there in the 1930s, and as they walked through the house, you could just see that we had changed a bunch of stuff, and that in some ways it was a really sad moment for them to walk through our house and just for their past to be gone. And I just remember my mother saying when they left, I bet they wish they hadn't done that. And, and you know, this story is told from the perspective of the woman who owns the house, who's partly my mother and not really my mother, but it's just about, the way all these objects around us, have meaning and no meaning, but also meaning to someone else, these incredible stories that we don't know about.
Well, the book is there are. Where's my other favorites? I mean, there's just so many good stories in here. The Why I Married My Wife is fabulous too. That's about these two guys. Twin brothers.
They're not brothers. They're neighbors. Yeah. Who decide to dig a tunnel? They're just sort of out of work guys.
No. These are Why I Married My Wife is about the armless.
Sorry. I was thinking about a story I can't say the title of on the air.
Yes, you can. No, you can't. That's why I'm not talking about that one. Not a WGN.
Why Marry My Wife?
Oh, yeah. This is just, I mean, this really is a haunting. In a way, it's another thing you bring up all the time are Dewar's Scotch. That's one of the themes through the book. It's about these two brothers.
That story, I mean, there's something that, you know, I think sometimes when we talk about, you know, I don't really love, well, I don't think the guys who practiced magical realism, Garcia Marquez, loved that term particularly.
Yes.
But
and
there
Borges.
And Borges is certainly one of my favorite all-time writers. But I do think the Midwest, one of the things I like about why I Married My Wife, or one thing I was interested in writing, it's kind of set in rural Indiana. And I just landscapes I knew really well. I had a lot of relatives from Indiana and spent a lot of time there as a kid and in rural areas. And I just, Garcia Marquez always said, you know, when he didn't set out to write magical realism, he set out to write about his childhood in a place where the rules were somehow different. And I tried to do that with the Midwest. I find our own landscapes magical and full of mystery. And so I think that story, which is about this these two brothers who have a falling out over a woman. And there's the narrator is a guy who comes in and meets one of these brothers as he's dying in a motorcycle crash, and the brother says to him, "Something is buried in this place," and it turns out that something.
And he goes
is,
to the living brother and say, "Hey, let's let's go find what your brother was talking about."
Exactly, and it turns out he's talking about the arm that one that brother chopped off the other brother. Yeah.
It's amazing, but we got to take a short break. Welcome back. I have only 10. I could talk to Miles Harvey for 5 hours, but they won't give me a show for 5 hours. Another story. Miles, in your amazing book, The Registry of Forgotten Objects, is the man who slept with Eudora Welty. Eudora Welty is mentioned at least twice in the book. Not trying to draw threads through this. Is this based at all on anything that might have happened to you? Because I'm reading it, and I said, oh, my God, this is going to happen to me. It's going to happen to me. It's charming, it's funny, and it's moving, I think.
Yeah, so it's not a true story. The story is about someone who happened to be in grad school at the University of Michigan.
Yes, exactly.
And happened to meet... an old character who claimed to have had a torrid love affair with Eudora Welty, who was otherwise thought to be a very chaste person.
Yes. Here's what he looked like. He must have been in his late 70s, maybe early 80s. His eyes were gray and unlit and dingy, as if peering out at me through soiled windows of an abandoned old house. Though I remember little else about his face. Eyes are a big thread through this book, too. And he hears his story, and he doesn't quite believe him, but he starts to research, doesn't he?
Yeah, the narrator, who is a lot like me and has friends with with my friends' names in grad school, but was not me. In fact, I mean, I think what's really true about this story is I wanted to write about the intimacy between reader and writer, and how this narrator comes to think he didn't know Welty work at all, which is probably true of me in graduate school. When I got there, I was pretty unread for being in a good program in creative writing, and comes to, just in trying to figure out whether the guy on the train was telling him the truth, comes to have this deep intimacy with Welty. And Welty was an amazing writer because she talked about that intimacy.
Yeah.
So, and also, really, for those of you who know her work, and for those of you who don't, I urge you to do it, to read it. Really complex writer who wrote about passion and not quite sex, but pretty darn close. For someone who was thought not to have had sex in her life. She was a very complex thinker about this subject, as we all are. But that story is... in a way, not at all true, and in a way, in the way that I just feel such, I just think the relationship between a writer and a reader is really one of the most intimate you can have, and that is very true to me.
You also have some amazing sentences in this one chapter. For instance, reality and fiction, it seems, have only become more and more muddled in my mind. I'm just picking, it's only a 5-page short story. Welty once wrote that the primary challenge of an author is, quote, to imagine yourself inside another person, end quote, a metamorphosis she described as, quote, making the jump. You also write, mere coincidences, perhaps, but whenever they happen, I feel both the shudder of recognition and the joy of being recognized if someone else is observing my life from the other side of the page. And then finally, I can't tell whether the tale I've just told about you is true or false, autobiographical or fiction.
And I mean, I think to a certain extent that's true. I'll say it's straight up fiction, but there's a part of it that feels very much, it's funny, some people have described it as that essay you wrote, and I kind of love that.
Because that's perfect.
It kind of is like an essay. It's just not true.
Yeah. Did you sleep with Welty? When, Miles, do you know? Because I think these short stories are so finely polished. They are filled with unexpected turns, but they are finely polished. When do you say to yourself, I'm finished?
So, I think, as you know, Rick, as a writer, you get a better sense of that as you get, as you work with words more and more and more. Those, I've heard someone describe words as sonic objects, which I just love. Those are my sonic objects there. But I'm also lucky in that I'm just going to give a shout out to, I'm in a writer's group still in Chicago, a bunch of great people and very supportive of each other. And I've also, from my days at Michigan, still have some very, very close writer friends who are, have all published books now, but we stay in touch, we read each other's work. I just think having someone who takes your work seriously is such such a blessing, and I'm blessed to have that, and that helps me figure out when something's done, too. I'll unashamedly run a story three or four drafts past my writers group and
until they say stop.
I don't know if I'd listen to them if they said stop, but I kind of know. Like they're just great readers, and they give me the information I need. And even when there's one of the nice things about being in a writers group is you get to know people's tastes and quirks, and you know what to ignore as well as what to learn from.
Yeah. Yeah, as head of the English department there, what are you teaching at DePaul these days?
Well, I'm teaching in the fall. I'm teaching this amazing course with it's called a global learning exchange course with a young journalist in Tbilisi in Georgia.
Oh, wow!
Her class and my class coordinate. We do this exercise together called the Sense of the City exercise, where the kids from Tbilisi have to write about a place in Tbilisi that somehow embodies their idea of Tbilisi, and the kids in Chicago have to do the same. And it's really, it's an amazing class. Yeah, and the woman I'm working with is, she works, those of you who know Georgian politics, she works in Formula, which is the anti-Russian TV station there that may soon be shut down. And she's just a very, like so many journalists, Rick, that you and I both know, very courageous person who just carries on with her job because she thinks it's important, and she has dreams that Georgia will one day be a fully democratic,
autonomous,
part of the, really wants it to be part of the European Union. And it's an amazing city, by the way. I got to travel there for this project, and it was just, wow, what a beautiful city.
Let Putin go. That's my theory on that. That will help. You seem so enthusiastic about teaching still. You seem, just in the way you look at the cover of this book and these stories between covers, how empowering is this, Miles? It must be on a sense. Not that you're going to say, honey, I'm quitting DePaul. I'm going to write short stories forever. It's got to, on some level, be, if not empowering, at least gratifying.
Yeah, I mean, as usual, Rick, you're really so perceptive. Yeah, this book means a lot to me, and all my books, as you know, all the books you write mean a lot to you. But this one feels like, it just feels like something that I'm really, really close to and proud of, and it will definitely already is destined to be, at least, I guess I had one book of nonfiction that sort of flopped, but this one, there's just not a market for it, so it's such a labor of love, but I'm really proud of it, and I'm really happy it's out in the world. And I just think, to get back to this sort of intimacy between writer and reader, I just think I love the idea that someone may discover this, pick it up at a garage sale down the road, and read it and feel joy,
I'll tell you this, I loved every single word of this. I'm never walking into a small town barber shop again, I will tell you that. And if you want to know why, you must read the book. You're going to be with my old friend Steve Edwards somewhere, aren't you?
Yeah, so Steve Edwards, formerly your friend and colleague at WBEZ, is kind enough to sort of moderate the book launch for this book, which is on September 12th at Bookends and Beginnings.
Oh, great.
In Evanston at, I think it's at 6 p.m. And
well, you have a good website. You can go to Miles Harvey. Again, I'm not going to spell that for you because you people are smart. You can go to milesharvey.com and do think of, I don't care if you're the big world's biggest fan of short story writing, do think about also, because this book is not that long and you'll need something else by Miles, and you might buy one of his nonfiction triumphs, because they all were. Mm. Are you working on something now?
I'm working on a few things, but probably not much to talk about. But hey, can I?
Yes.
Can I do something here really quick?
Go ahead.
In honor of the haikus that we heard in the first hour of the show, I've written a haiku for you, and I counted it out. And this is my first public haiku. Rick.
Okay. Good luck.
Thank you, Rick Kogan. Our town would be less itself without you in it.
That's great. I'm going to book you to perform at Fitzgerald's. You got to write a whole song to go with that.
That's all I got.
Miles, thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you. MilesHarvey.com.